These are in listen-only mode.
Welcome to today's webinar, hosted by SNEB and sponsored by the Dairy Council of California. Dairy Council of California is an SNEB organizational member, and I'm very proud to be working together again on a webinar. Past webinars have been some of the most popular and informative in the SNEB archives, so I'm very glad to be able to present this topic to you today. I'll start us off with a little bit of housekeeping. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Associate Executive Director of SNEB, and today's slides are in the handout module of GoToWebinar. So if you look in your toolbar, you'll see a place where you can download the slides and follow along during the presentation. We will take questions. There's a break between presenters, and we can take a couple questions at that point, and then we'll also take questions at the end of the webinar. So please type those in the question block, and we will moderate those to the presenter. If for some reason we have more questions than we have time for, I know we have a lot of good information today, we'll do a follow-up to the webinar, taking a look at answering those questions. And so watch for an email from me. I'll have that out on by Friday of this week with a link to the recording that we're making, the slides as a handout again, the CEU certificate, and any other resource material. There, sometimes during these webinars, there's things that come up that we want to share with you. So we'll include that in the follow-up email that comes out on Friday. When I close out the session today, there'll be a short survey, and we appreciate your feedback on this session as well as ideas for future topics for webinars. So our moderator today is Lori Houlihan. Lori is Manager of Nutrition Research at the Dairy Council of California. She's responsible for staying abreast of health and nutrition research and sharing it, when ready, with health professional and consumer audiences.
Thank you, Rachel, and thanks for this opportunity to have this webinar in conjunction with SNEB. So all of us who work in the health and nutrition field know that consumers are more skeptical than ever before and are seeking information from a range of sources, credible or not. They may try out a new diet based on a success story from a neighbor. They may give up a whole food group to lose weight. Or they may avoid a common food ingredient for its alleged health effects that they read about in a blog or on Facebook. You can imagine, and I'm sure you have stories of your own, of how these actions lead to unintended nutrition consequences and sometimes harmful health effects. Trust in our food supply and in credible nutrition information is critical to the health of consumers. So the purpose of this webinar is shown here in the learning objectives. So we hope that over the course of this webinar, you'll learn about and practice values-based communication skills to engage more effectively with consumers, patients, clients, and colleagues, that you'll be able to provide some balance and perspective to the food and nutrition dialogue through meaningful connections, and that you'll be empowered to utilize tools and strategies to rebuild consumer trust in nutrition science and the food supply, positioning the nutrition and health professional as the experts. So with that short background, I'd like to introduce our two speakers, both of whom are with the Center for Food Integrity, or CFI. Our first speaker is J.J. Jones, who joined CFI almost 2 years ago. A product of Northwest Kansas, J.J. received degrees in animal science and industry and in national agriculture from Kansas State University. Since then, he has developed a career in agricultural communications and marketing. He brings tremendous communication and organizational skills to the CFI team, and enjoy sharing the story of food and agriculture across the U.S. and around the world. Most of all, I love his approach to this topic. He believes there are no problems, only opportunities to find solutions. I think that's something we can all work on in our careers and in our lives in general. Our second speaker, Sarah Down, received her bachelor's degree in dietetics from the University of Wyoming and her MBA and RD at Dominican University. Her passion for nutrition communications evolved during her work on the food and nutrition teams at Kellogg Company, Golin, Weber Shandwick, and Food Minds. She joined CFI about a year ago, where she's the first in-house RD, a perfect fit for her and her passion for food, agriculture, and nutrition communications. She is a business-savvy foodie and loves to find ways to help others through good food and innovative fun ideas. So please help me in welcoming and thanking these two dynamic speakers for the session today. And with that, I'll hand it over to you, JJ, and your screen.
Excellent. Thank you, Lori, and thank you, Rachel, for allowing us to join you all this afternoon. And this morning, I guess I should say. So good morning, everyone. So let's dive right in. And oftentimes, one of the first questions we get is, who are you at the Center for Food Integrity? And so we, like many organizations, are very mission-driven, and our primary mission is to earn and maintain consumer trust in today's food system. And so we really, if you were to look at our membership roster and our project partners, you would see the depth and breadth of the food system in terms of individuals who want to come together to earn consumer trust in today's food system. And we primarily do this through three ways. One is we strive to be a leading voice in a balanced public conversation about food. Because as was alluded to earlier by both Lori and Rachel, we know that consumers have many, many questions about the food system. And fortunately, we have many choices within the food system, and we also have many voices. And so we do try to work collectively to be one of those leading voices that consumers can turn to as they're making the very important decision about what foods they want to consume themselves, but also purchase maybe for their family or their loved ones. We have a hypothesis that at times people would demonstrate or would believe that the food system is not in alignment with today's culture of what consumers are looking for. And so we work hard to align or demonstrate that in many cases, the culture of the food system and the culture of consumers is actually more closely aligned than some would have us believe. So we work to align the culture of today's food system. And then we also work with our members and partners to convene, empower, and support food system stakeholders so that they have a better understanding of what consumers are looking for, where they're going for information, who they're listening to, et cetera, so that, again, as they try to maintain and earn trust within the food system, they do that in a more informed way. We do have two websites that I would draw your attention to. The first is our member and partner-facing website, like you all, foodintegrity.org. That you can visit there. And then we also have a consumer-facing website, bestfoodfacts.org, that we like to refer to as kind of the WebMD for the food system, if you will. So if consumers have questions about certain products or production methods, processing methods, et cetera, they can go to Best Food Facts and they can either find the answer to a question that's already been asked, and those answers are provided by nearly 300 different subject matter experts from across North America. Or if they can't find the answer to their question, they can go ahead and submit that question to us, and we will work with our experts to find the answer for them. And so if you look at a lot of what we're going to cover today, and all of it is based on our annual consumer trust research that we've been doing for nearly a decade, a lot of it is based on the social sciences as we aim and strive to better understand the consumer decision-making process. So all of our models are built on key learnings from anthropology, sociology, and psychology. And as you see in the middle of the Venn diagram on the screen, that's really where we feel and we find that we get the key insights into the consumer decision-making process. As Lori mentioned, I am from Northwest Kansas. I believe I'm a product of Northwest Kansas. So this is what I grew up looking at every morning and evening as I woke up on my family's cattle ranch. And at first I thought I wanted to always work in cattle. So while you all were studying dietetics and nutrition for humans, I was, from a young age, studying dietetics and nutrition for beef cattle. But then as I began to travel around the world and enter into conversations with various food system stakeholders, as Lori alluded to, I discovered that I really liked talking more about the food system than actually being part of the production process. And I also enjoyed the fact that we do have such a robust food system, not only here in the United States, but around the world. And we have consumers who have questions, and we want to make sure that we're meeting their expectations in terms of answering those questions and providing information they can use for their family and loved ones. So what I'm going to cover in the portion that I'm responsible for today is the decline of trust and how we arrived at the situation we're at today. So as was alluded to earlier, and I think we all agree, there is this mistrust at times in the food system, and so how did we get here? And then we've done some research on, well, how do you earn and maintain trust not only in the food system, but in any organization in general, but obviously we apply it to the food system. And then we'll do a quick overview of the foundational research that CFI has done over the last several years. Sarah and I have gone through that research and picked out some key components that we feel you all might be interested in your daily lives as dietitians and nutritionists. So we know that today more consumers are asking more and more questions about the food system. And so at times we may hear questions or comments like those that are populating the screen in front of you. Things like, I'm worried about GMOs in my food. I hear they're bad for us and the environment. Or my friends say that processed foods are unhealthy. Or I'm concerned about antibiotics, that farmers give to their animals. I don't want antibiotics in my food. And so for those of us who are ingrained in the food system on a daily basis, sometimes our reaction looks a little bit like the gentleman on the screen, where we want to pull our hair out and we want to scream because we don't know exactly where to begin as we engage in a more meaningful conversation with consumers about so many of these very important topics. But we actually see this as a prime opportunity. It's an opportunity to engage and address their individual concerns and skepticisms, to address their individual questions, and truly find a way to have that more meaningful conversation about the food system. We know that today's consumers have a shifting societal attitude. As I mentioned earlier, there are many choices within the food system, and there are many voices sharing information about the food system. And so there's become, though, this mistrust in food and farming, even though we see in our research that more and more consumers have a desire to know and trust farmers or those who are processing or manufacturing various food products. So as I mentioned earlier, we want to discuss a little bit of, well, how did we get to where we're at today? And in 1988, January of 1988, Time magazine declared that 1968 was the year that began to shape a generation. And so if you look back, beginning in 1968 to today, there have been a frequent number of public violations of trust. So whether it be military leaders, political leaders, religious leaders, and business leaders, whomever, there's been this consistent violation of trust. And it's been consistent enough over the last four-plus decades that it's bred this broad public skepticism about whether or not institutions are worthy of trust. And the food system is no different. And then, as I mentioned, we started to have this social shift within society. And so if you look at 1968 and before, authority was primarily granted by the office that somebody held. But today, we see that authority is primarily granted by the relationship that we hold with someone. So it's not enough just to simply have the title of president or CEO or general or pastor, etc. Today, individuals are looking for how do they have a relationship with you as an individual. Should they grant you their trust based on that relationship? It used to be that broad social consensus was primarily driven by white Anglo-Saxon Protestant males, but today we see that there's really no single social consensus group, but there's rather great diversity and, again, many voices in the conversation on a variety of topics, and food is no different. It used to be that communication was formal, it was indirect, you have mass communication. I often share that I grew up on a ranch in western Kansas where on a good day we had four TV stations. It was NBC, ABC, CBS, and PBS. Our family happened to be an NBC station family. So every night at 5:30 we sat down and we listened to Tom Brokaw share the day's news both on the national and international level. And for the next 24 hours, that's what our family discussed with other family members, and our network of friends and acquaintances. But today we see that communication is very informal, it's very direct, and we have masses of communicators. So the chances of us only listening to one or two news outlets is pretty slim. Many of us have multiple news outlets that we go to, and it's not just the traditional media that we're looking to for our news information. We're also going to social media platforms, and we're going to friends and family who are online or not online. So there's a variety of ways that we're being communicated with. It used to be that progress was inevitable. So if we developed a science or technology, whether it was in the food system or aeronautics or healthcare, if we had that science or technology, it was inevitable that we would use it in our minds for the betterment of humankind. But today we see more and more consumers saying, well, progress is possible. Just because we have the science or technology to do something doesn't mean that we should use it, so progress is possible. And finally, there was a big is respected concept prior to 1968, where the larger an institution or an organization was, the more respect it commanded. But today, increasingly through our research, we see that the big is bad bias is very real. And so again, it starts to raise questions in consumers' minds with the larger an organization is, can I really trust them? Can I place my trust in them to put my interest or society's interest ahead of their interest, which is primarily profit in many cases? So just as the food system began to consolidate, integrate, and industrialize maybe about 20 or 30 years ago, you again started to see this decline of trust in society in general, this growing skepticism. And so that really played in to people's perceptions of the food system as well. So we noticed that the public senses a change in the way food is produced, but they really aren't for sure why. And they start to ask the question, is this change having a positive effect on me and my family and my loved ones, or is this change only for the benefit of a food company or a farmer or a rancher or another institution that maybe has that profit motivation bias? And it only makes sense that we would have such robust conversations surrounding food, because food is necessary. It's traditional. It's very personal. It's something that we mourn with, we celebrate with. We provide it to the most vulnerable in our society. So again, as there's this growing skepticism, especially with larger entities in the food system, we can see why that is. So as I mentioned earlier, every year we do an annual consumer trust survey where we're really trying to determine what do consumers think about the food system today? And then we also take a deeper dive into specific topic areas to better understand how those topic areas affect consumer decision making and obviously consumers' trust level within the food system. While we survey over 2,000 U.S. consumers every year that model the demographics of the United States, there's three or four groups that we're especially interested in. So moms, millennials, foodies, and early adopters. We have three represented there that we'll talk about throughout today. And the reason we're interested in these three groups so much is we know that when it comes to food system conversations, many times they're some of the leading voices in asking questions or providing information about the food system. So we really want to see and take a deeper dive into what moms, millennials, and foodies think. So the first thing we always ask consumers is to share with us, not only for food system issues, but life issues in general. What are the most concerning life issues affecting you today? One of the things you'll see, and these are the top five from 2015, that actually all of the most concerning life issues are actually beyond consumers' direct control. So you can see in 2015, the number one concern for most U.S. consumers was the rising health care costs, followed by rising cost of food. And then coming in third was the U.S. economy, but then fourth was keeping healthy food affordable, and finally, rising energy costs. If we start to break that down a little bit, we see that in most cases, women are more concerned about most issues than men. We can see there's some additional issues that were rated highly that pertain to the food system. So also, 62% of consumers shared that they were highly concerned with food safety. 53% said they were highly concerned with having enough food to feed the U.S., and then 47% said a high level of concern was humane treatment of farm animals. One of the mantras that we use many times in the food system is that we need to feed a growing world population, but that's actually the lowest concern topic for many U.S. consumers. In fact, only 31% of U.S. consumers said that's a top concern for them, is having enough food to feed people outside of the United States. If we break that down by those three or four demographics that we really take a deeper dive into, you start to see some interesting patterns where, for moms, their number one concern is the rising cost of food, with number three still being keeping healthy food affordable. But then if we turn to millennials, you can actually see that their top two concerns out of all life issues have to do with the food system. So obviously number one is keeping healthy food affordable, and number two is the rising cost of food. If we switch over to foodies and early adopters, again, you see the same pattern repeated again, where for foodies, keeping healthy food affordable is number one, followed by rising cost of food at number three, and then for early adopters, again, rising cost of food at one and keeping healthy food affordable at number three. A top concern, again, if we were to summarize what we just saw, is a top concern is finding healthy, affordable food, while the lowest concern is having enough food to feed people outside of the U.S. So again, as we're trying to align our information with the information that consumers are looking for, these are two key insights that come to our mind. We also like to understand if consumers feel the food system is headed in the right direction or if it's on the wrong track. So we have the last 3 years, 2013 through 2015, and you can see we've actually made some modest increases in those consumers who feel the food system is heading in the right direction. But we still have a significant number of consumers who feel the food system is headed on the wrong track, or those who are unsure about the food system. So again, to us, this is a key insight that all of us who are stakeholders and leaders within the food system, like all of you on the call today, we have a responsibility to see how can we make sure that consumers are comfortable that the food system is headed in the right direction. And we're not trying to share with them what that food system should or should not look like, but we want them to have a comfort level in the food system that works for them. So then if we break that down by, again, moms, millennials, and foodies, you start to see how those demographics feel the food system is headed, if it's headed in the right direction or if it's on the wrong track or if it's unsure. What was interesting to us, and we have the number on the left in each column is the 2014 data. The number on the right is the 2015 data. What's interesting is about half of foodies believe that the food system is headed in the right direction. What this is telling us anyway is that foodies have found a food system that is starting to work for them. Obviously, you still have 50% who still feel it's on the wrong track or they're unsure, but that's the highest group that feels the food system is heading in the right direction. Conversely, then, what the data shares with us is that moms are the most conflicted. That's a group of consumers who it's about a third, and a third, especially if we look, if we were to do some basic rounding, but the fact that there's 37% of moms who are unsure, again, tells us we have a large task ahead to make sure that we're earning and maintaining trust within the food system that they choose. Because we are trying to communicate about the food system, we always like to know where consumers are engaging, where do they go for their information. We see that the digital communication method is still on the rise. So if you were to combine Google at the right end of your screen with websites at the left, it's nearly a third of consumers say their number one place they go for information is on a website. And then that's followed by their local TV station and then friends and family not on the line. And over the years, we've seen the digital platform continue to rise year after year. So as I mentioned, then our second objective to cover early on here in the webinar is, well, if we want to earn and maintain trust, we better understand what it is that affects whether a consumer will trust an individual or an organization. And the reason we want trust is that implies to us a freedom to operate for an organization, because society has given you a social license that they feel you're doing what's right for them and society in general. So therefore, they're not putting rules or regulations in place to govern how you operate as a business or an entity. And they do that, they grant you that social license because they have trust in you. So when we began back in 2007 and then we finally peer-reviewed and published this research in 2009, we found that there's three factors that affect an individual's trust on an organization or an entity. And the first is influential others. So they're looking at those voices around them, those people they have a relationship with who are sharing information with them. And so they're going to look to those who are influential in their decision-making process. But then they're also going to look for an organization or an entity or individual that has a technical competency. Do they have the skills and knowledge? So for example, if they have a nutrition question, are they going to come to a dietitian or nutritionist? If they have an animal well-being question, are they going to come to a veterinarian or an animal ethicist, someone who has studied a particular topic area in great detail? But then the other area they look for is confidence, or does that individual or entity have a value similarity? And what we found is that shared values or confidence is actually 3 to 5 times more important in building trust than sharing facts or demonstrating technical skills and competency or expertise alone. And so we would propose that in many cases within the food system, we've had this exactly in reverse. Because many of us are very scientific and economically minded, we tend to like to share facts first. But what we found is that as consumers are evaluating where to place their trust in the food system, they're first of all looking for shared values. So we have to do a better job of sharing our values as the food system first. Because like I said, we like to talk about the science and economics, the what and the how. So we have to shift the conversation and change our approach from saying things like research proves it's okay to do this or financially it's in our best interest. We need to shift to something more like, well, it sounds like food safety is important to you. Or we need to identify how can we find those shared values. We've also looked at through our research, well, who should engage if we're trying to demonstrate shared values? And we have a list here of individuals that we know consumers look towards for food system information, but the list goes on and on, especially if that individual, whether it be a family doctor or a veterinarian or a farmer, if they're able to share their values in the leading points of the conversation. As I mentioned, we pulled out some highlights from our previous foundational research. One of the things that we know from our research 2 years ago and then last year as well, as we took a deeper dive, is that consumers are expecting greater transparency within the food system. And especially they're looking for things, excuse me, I hit too many buttons at once, for things like policies. Does an organization share with me what I'm supposed to do in regarding various topics? They're looking for practices. What is that organization actually doing? They're looking for performance. What has the organization done in the past regarding a variety of topics within the food system? And then finally, they're also looking for verification. Is someone else validating that this company or organization is following its own policies and practices? If we looked at, well, who do consumers hold the most responsible for various topics within the food system? And there on the left, we have six topics that were identified by some qualitative focus groups, so things like impact of food on health and food safety on down through animal well-being and business ethics. We find that the majority of consumers allocate out of 100 points, the majority of points towards food companies. So you can see for things like impact of food on health, out of 100 points, the average U.S. consumer places 41% of their 41 of those 100 points on food companies, followed by 28 on farmers, then 16 on grocery stores and 15 on restaurants. And you can see how the numbers are displayed for each of those various topic areas. And there might be some areas that's a little surprising. For example, the fact that many consumers look to food companies when it comes to animal well-being policies and practices. However, as many of us may know, it's really farmers and ranchers who have the most impact on animal well-being. But again, what this tells us is there's that opportunity for greater communication within various sectors of the food system to make sure we're getting consumers the information that they're looking for. So what does this all mean? Well, the takeaways from transparency are the fact that transparency is no longer optional. We heard this loud and clear through both our qualitative and quantitative research that it's a basic consumer expectation. And in fact, what we heard from some of the qualitative focus group participants is that if a company or an organization doesn't appear to be transparent, consumers feel that's because it's either they don't have a good story to tell or they're actually trying to hide something. Consumers want information on company practices because while they're also looking at things like policies and verification, practices are an illustration of your values in action. And as we know from our initial research, values are what drive trust. And then finally, consumers want the ability to engage. And Sarah will talk a little bit more about engaging here in a little bit. But one of the things we know is that because communication models are very indirect and very informal, or excuse me, very direct and informal, we know that consumers want that ability to ask questions, to be heard, so that as they're engaging in conversations with food system stakeholders, it's a two-way communication channel. So the basic thing I would leave you with from our research is that we continue to find that it's not about abandoning science or facts, but rather it's leading with our shared values in order to build trust. And by leading with shared values, then we're able to earn permission from consumers to then share the science and facts about various food system topics. So with that, let me pause there for just a minute and ask what burning questions might you have about at least our foundational research before Sarah takes this a deeper dive into how this may apply to you all in your day-to-day activities. Initial burning questions?
Okay, it looks like there's maybe just one, JJ, that maybe you could answer quickly, and that's along the lines of what percentage of the funding for your research comes from the agricultural industry?
Yes, great question. So 100% of our funding would come from food and agricultural organizations and entities. So we have, if you were to go on our website, you would see many various partners and members, nearly 200 different members and partners, and all of them fund research in some form or fashion. And then we work with our research partners to conduct that research. But one of the big things that we make sure our members and partners know is just because you are a sponsor or a member of CFI or a sponsor of the research, you don't get editorial rights to the research. The research is what it is.
Great, thank you. So, yeah, we'll go ahead and hand it on to Sarah then for the application section of the webinar.
Great. Thanks so much, JJ, and thank you to the Dairy Council of California and SNEB for having us today. So I'm just going to start with a little bit of background about me. And so I originally grew up in Denver, and I was raised in suburbs, and while my parents, they introduced us to where our food came from, we really didn't have the opportunity to see what that looked like. And that kind of all changed when I went to the University of Wyoming, and I was placed on the agriculture floor in my dorm, not knowingly, and it turned out to be really great, and I was able to learn from a lot of my friends that I made there. And also having the dietetics program within the College of Agriculture at Wyoming really allowed me to see the different sides that agriculture can play, especially as it relates to nutrition. And so these are just a couple of photos of how I kind of made my way. As you can see, there is a picture of me at my first branding. One of my best friends in college, she has a cattle ranch just outside of Laramie, Wyoming. And so that was my very first time experiencing that. And really, that combined with my studies and getting to know more about agriculture has led me to where I am today. As Lori mentioned, I do have background in nutrition communications, and I spent some time at Kellogg within their nutrition marketing department, but I still was kind of searching for that agriculture piece to bring me back to my roots. And so the fit with the Center for Food Integrity and being able to work with both agriculture and nutrition has really been great for me. So a little overview of what I'm going to talk about on this portion is I'm going to discuss the barriers and frustration that registered dietitians and nutrition professionals will need to overcome in order for us to be able to promote the work of our profession. Another piece is dissecting why facts and the values-based statements are key to effective nutrition communications. We're also going to talk a little bit about the strategies regarding when and how you should use value-based statements. And the last piece is showing you guys just how values-based communication can be used in different types of dietetic and nutrition settings. So a few barriers and frustrations, which I'm sure a lot of you experience on the day-to-day. The first one is there are so many nutrition experts, and they have such loud voices, as you probably all know, and they can become very influential because of those loud voices. And unfortunately, a key tactic of theirs is coupling bad science with fear. Another barrier of frustration would be that bad science. So this is just an example of one of the pieces that was released. It was in 2012 from Dr. Oz publicized a study claiming that green tea coffee extract pills were proven to be a miracle weight loss secret. And with this celebrity endorsement and a catchy headline, many people fell for this claim, and the Twitterverse exploded with all this chatter. And many mainstream media outlets, they published stories about the study, and they spread this false information. And it really wasn't until 2015 that the Federal Trade Commission investigated the study, and they found that the researchers actually failed to follow standard scientific protocol. And they even altered some of the results to prove their hypothesis. So this is just one example of how bad science can lead to misinformation. And eventually the study was retracted, but this wasn't before the producer of those green coffee extract pills had sold over $50 million worth of products to the public. Another one was the buzzwords, and we hear these all the time from in the grocery stores or if we're at a barbecue and people are talking to us about the different buzzwords that they hear, and they can be extremely scary and difficult to explain for a lot of consumers, and that can create a barrier when we're trying to communicate about nutrition. And the last is the media, of course. And an example of this was a study that was based just on pure junk. And the person behind it was actually a science journalist. And he carried out this elaborate hoax to expose just how easily bad nutrition science gets disseminated in the mainstream media. And so it was all about how he fooled everyone into thinking chocolate helps with weight loss. So those are just a couple examples of the barriers and frustrations that we face currently within the nutrition profession. And, of course, all of these lead to the fear of food and where we're at today. And coupled with that is all, and JJ kind of talked about this before, is just all the different choices and marketing claims to decipher can be really confusing for consumers, and it leads them to not really be able to focus on the facts, but to really be using their values and emotions instead. And it may not be rational the way that they make this decision, but it's reality. So what's not working? Well, we need to be able to collaborate more as a profession and fight less, I think. First, our instinct tells us to often defend with science and economics. But as we mentioned before, that doesn't necessarily help to build trust and communicate our message both effectively and efficiently. We definitely need to be able to reevaluate and maybe just take a step back and come together collaboratively as a profession and think about our common goals and values with consumers and clients that we may be speaking with. So all along the food industry, we've been answering the wrong question. Yes, science says that we can, but consumers aren't really asking if we can. They're asking if we should. And that's an ethical question that can only really be answered with values. So when we're talking about values, a lot of times we also think about our communication goal. And a lot of times we just want to persuade, or we want to also educate. And the thing to remember here is that when you're building trust with communication, if your only goal is to change the minds of others or persuade them, we'll lose. And also, if your first goal is to educate and change opinions, then we'll also lose, which is kind of a shift in thinking for many of us. So instead, our goal should be to embrace the skepticism and realize that these consumer concerns are real, and this perception is their reality. And so what do we need to do next is to be able to share our values and things that we have in common with them. So how do you effectively engage with consumers about food issues? Well, the first thing for us specifically and as nutrition professionals and dietitians is understanding why facts and values are important to us. We know that as a science-based profession with deep roots in communication, that being able to communicate properly is extremely important. And oftentimes we are the first line in discussion about food, whether it be talking with clients or patients. They go to us as the experts. Also, being able to use facts and values really helps to amplify the credibility in our profession. And if we really become rock star communicators in nutrition, I think that says a lot about our profession. And the last one is making sure that nutrition, by using facts and values, it makes nutrition communications more effective and meaningful for who you're speaking with. So before you engage, there's a couple things to keep in mind. The first one is to be committed to having a conversation and not just about educating or defending or correcting misinformation, which can be kind of hard to do at times. The second is to be principle-driven. So know your own values first and what you stand for and what's important to you and how your different values can drive what you're talking about when it comes to ag and food. The next would be to keep your emotions in check, and this can be difficult sometimes when we see all this misinformation and crazy headlines about different types of research and nutrition diets and fads, and our emotions can kind of go all over the place because we're very passionate about what we do, but we need to be able to take a step back and kind of keep those in check before we have those conversations. And the golden question we need to think about is, do they recognize my ethical right to be involved in farming and food production? And that all comes from being able to show that your values are similar to theirs. So as a piece of the Center for Food Integrity, and when we're teaching about shared values and values-based communication, we like to use this engage principle, and it's all about listen, ask, and share. So the first step is listening, and we need to be able to listen for values and those shared values without judgment. And this is a great quote that I like to talk about when I'm thinking about listening, is most people do not listen with the intent to understand. They listen with the intent to reply. So we first need to seek to first be understood, and then we need to understand what they're trying to say, and then we need to they'll be able to understand what we're trying to communicate with them. And so another piece is this, is knowing that not every conversation is meant to be. And also to keep in mind that there's a movable middle, and those ones on the far end of this bell curve are ones that we're not going to really be able to change their mind, and to really focus on that movable middle and those who are interested and have questions about food. And so when we think about listening, here are a couple of examples, and thinking about what does this person value. And so if you think about all these different scenarios here on the screen, a lot of them, they tend to have some certain values that are similar. And while it's important to remember that everyone has different values, there are a lot of different values we've noticed from the research that many people have in common. And some of those include healthy and affordable food and food safety. And so you can see that some of those values are coming out within these statements and are ways that you could also connect with people that might be talking about things like this. So the next piece is to ask questions, to invite the dialogue, and to really be able to understand more where they're coming from. So after you've heard their values, you need to ask questions, and asking questions will help make sure that you're both on the same page and to show them that you really care about what they have to say. So when you're asking questions, be sure that you acknowledge what they've said. And this shows that you've heard the question or the statement. So you can just repeat that question and just make sure that you understand. And then also asking questions shows that you're working to understand them better too. And the last piece is to share your perspective through your values. So when you get to the point where you're connecting at the values level and you're in a real conversation where there's mutual interest, then you have the opportunity to share your perspective. This is where, through your values, you can talk about why you do what you do, why you're committed to protecting the land if you're involved in agriculture, or why you're committed to ensuring a safe food supply, or providing the best nutrition information out there. And then after you can share those different mutual interests and values, you can back that up with the science and in your explanation of how that is done. So really, we're not abandoning the science, we're just switching the way that we talk about it. And so a key piece and tips for when you are sharing your values is utilizing bridging. And so when you get to the point where you're connecting at the values level, you want to really be sure that you have different opportunities to lead into that, because a lot of times it can be a little awkward of how do I get to that point in that conversation, and that's where bridging comes in. So these are some examples. So that's a great question and something we're constantly thinking about, or that's an interesting viewpoint. Another way to think about it is, so this is where it bridges that gap between your values and that science without it kind of seeming forced or not fitting within the conversation. So another key piece through all of this is to remember to choose your words wisely and lead with those shared values. So words are powerful. Here's an example. At E. coli, he just couldn't understand why business was bad. Whoops. So again, this just shows how important words are and how meaningful they can be. So what's your strategy? And this is where we can kind of discuss more about what is important to you and what's your personal strategy, and thinking about the examples of your own strategy. This is the hard part, and we can't tell you what your personal strategy is, but we can give you some guidance on what you need to think about for developing that personal strategy. And another thing to think about is what drives you and what are your values? And we talked about this before, but this is really important. And an example to kind of get to this point is to think about what your top five values are. For example, mine would be family, integrity, passion, kindness, and happiness. And so when I first started practicing shared values, it was tough because I thought I wasn't able to connect to a lot of different individuals based on different things we had in common. But when I took a step back and looked at our different values, it made it a lot easier to be able to communicate with them. So engaging with an audience. Here are some ideas for when you're using values-based messaging and how you can really engage with different audiences. So the first is remembering that you're the expert and to post about your life as a dietitian. The next is to use events and personal anecdotes as a springboard for ideas. Also giving virtual tours, whether it be your refrigerator, your lunchbox, or the kitchen. This really helps to give people insights into maybe what you value and to be able to share with them on a personal level. Sharing your personal stories is always important when you're engaging. Showing people where their food comes from, this is extremely important. And just remembering that there's not going to be perfection within this when you're engaging with an audience and to really just be able to start using these different tips and tricks to make your way. And the last piece here is using photos and videos to tell your story and creating content responding to inaccurate info, which we always, I feel like, as a profession, have to do quite often. So how do we use values-based communication in different dietetic settings? Well, when we think about counseling, and this brings us back to our undergrad days for me and learning about motivational interviewing when we're counseling, and we think about this diagram that we have here. These principles of values-based messaging, they fit well here, especially in the pre-contemplation phase up at the top there. And it says here that to raise awareness, and oftentimes we get stuck here, but what if we could utilize values-based communication in this stage as a tool to move them to the next phase of contemplation? And, of course, being sure to use these principles throughout all of the stages. But remember that consumers and clients' concerns are real, and while they may seem silly, they shouldn't be brushed off. So really find out what their values are when you're communicating with them and counseling with them. The next would be with food service and management. And oftentimes in management positions, and especially food service, where there's lots going on, communication can be lost, and many people communicate differently, we know. So trying values-based messaging when you're connecting with others, you may realize that you have more in common with them than you think, and it may be easier to communicate with them about different components of your workday. And also, when you're thinking about different picky customers you may have that have questions about the food that you're serving, using values-based messaging is a great place to practice doing that. And last example here is with research. So we know the research is done, but now what? Well, when we utilize values-based messaging, when we're communicating the research and when pitching to media, it will help to provide these different journalists and media outlets with correct information and to help them understand more about your research and to be able to them to be able to use that information you provided them to spread the correct information instead of the misinformation that often happens when media pick up news, new research, and things of that matter. So what else can you do? The first thing is to just practice. Second is to become involved on social media, and this is a great place to practice your values-based messaging as well. This includes Twitter chats and making sure that you use your values-based communication when you're talking with people on Twitter and social media. Here are just a few individuals within the dietetic profession that I think do it well. And you can see them there. There are lots of dietitians and a few people within the agriculture community, like Kevin Folta. And another way is to be able to build a network of credentialed resources that you can rely on. And last is to advocate for your profession as nutritionists and registered dietitians. So the last thing that I want to leave here with you guys is that know that you make a difference within your profession and that conversations about food and agriculture are empowered and they're enlightened by you. And no one can tell your story and share your values the way that you can. And this is one of my favorite quotes from Theodore Roosevelt. No one cares how much you know until they know how much you care. And this really just ties in all of the information that we've been talking about today. And so, again, we just like to mention a couple of resources that we have. So we have the CFIEngage.org, and that is where those Engage principles come in place with the Listen, Ask, Share. We have Best Food Facts, which JJ talked about earlier, bestfoodfacts.org, and then we have the Center for Food Integrity, which is foodintegrity.org. So with that, I thank you so much for your time today, and if you have any questions, please let us know.
Great. Thank you, Sarah. And it looks like we have a few minutes for questions. You really drove home the point that it's important to position food and nutrition professionals as the experts in light of the number of loud and influential voices out there. I think as dietitians and nutrition professionals, we don't always have training on how to toot our own horns or to, you know, kind of make ourselves credible, but we all need to have strategies and tools in our toolboxes to do just that, to maintain that integrity and that respect. So let's see. So we do have a couple of questions that have come in. One, this is for Sarah. So you talked about using personal stories as a platform. And so the question is, do you still seem professional if you use personal stories? And sort of what's the balance between the personal and the professional message that you want to get out there?
I think that's a great question. I think the key is to remember, again, how with values, we lead with those values or lead with that personal story and that connection and then follow with the science. And so I think as long as you have the balance between the two, you'll really be able to connect with different individuals in a way that you may be more able to before. Because I think when you lead with that personal story, that you talk about what matters to you, I think they're able to connect with you, and then they're more willing to listen to that science and that research piece that you have that will follow.
Great. Okay. So, JJ, this one is for you. The U.S. has shifted from an agrarian or an agricultural society to a more industrial and technology-based society. Do you think that because so many people are removed from the production side of food, that this is part of the mistrust issue?
No, I think Melissa, you've hit the question or the topic right on the head, the nail on the head there, if I can get my things correct. That is a big part of it, that because so many of us are not involved in the day-to-day production of food, whether it be actually working on the farm or ranch or actually working in a food processing business because of technology advancements. The U.S. has one of the least expensive, most available, most affordable food supplies in the world. And so that does cause consumers to have questions because they're not as involved on a day-to-day basis. And so that's a wonderful opportunity for, as Sarah highlighted, for us to think about how can we make sure that as consumers have questions about various aspects of the food system, whether it be at the farm gate or more closely related to the actual dinner plate, how do we answer those? And again, we have to demonstrate that the values that we bring to the table as food system leaders in many cases are more closely aligned to their values as a consumer. And then because we have that value similarity, then we can start to share, well, here's why we use certain technologies or here's why we use certain production or processing practices. And then there may be those cases where our values aren't similar, and so we have to move on from there or find a way that we can compromise. But the advances due to technology have contributed to that mistrust, I would say yes.
Okay, great. So Sarah, this one is for you. If you're in a situation where somebody is citing a specific reference to perhaps not a very credible research, and you know that there's a study that refutes that, but you can't quite put your finger on the citation, how would you handle that?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I think it has been happening a lot more often than we probably would like. But I think the key to remember here is to know when, first thing is to knowing when to engage. So looking at that study that maybe you have found, and is it getting a lot of media pickup, and what's the engagement there? Because a lot of times we don't want to draw attention to something necessarily if it, you know, why break yourself into jail, as they like to say sometimes, but also if it is, you know, getting significant pickup and something that needs to be addressed, I think you can definitely be able to utilize the values-based messaging, whether that mean even reaching out to the researcher and maybe just asking more about what they've done with that research, or whether it's an article, reaching out to the journalists, and just to kind of be able to connect with them on a different level and to find out more before we completely attack, per se. But, again, as a profession, too, and making sure that we stand for science, which I am extremely passionate about, I think sometimes it does warrant that we do need to post things about corrections within studies and really stand for that background that we have within science and research. And so I think that when we're presenting and communicating about it, I think it really just comes down to making sure that we're not on the defense, and that the way that we present maybe these corrections about a study are not to blame or to attack anyone, but to merely just inform and provide a different perspective. Just so you know, we don't get into any, we've seen it before with those social media fights that can kind of happen, and they can kind of waste a lot of time and are not very effective with our time and resources. So,
okay. Great, thanks. So JJ, this one's for you. How can nutrition communicators learn more about what manufacturers do in sourcing ingredients, formulating foods, and marketing to be able to give balanced advice?
Oh, that's a great question. So one of the first things that comes to mind is we do see, and this was part of the reason we did our research on transparency, there is this greater desire, whether it be from nutrition communicators or consumers in general, looking for topics like that are listed there in terms of, or that were listed in the question, sourcing of ingredients, formulating of foods, etc. So many manufacturers are putting that type of information on their website. Also, you can always, many of them have a contact us where you can submit a question directly to them. And I know many of our partners and members who have been looking at the transparency research are finding ways that they can more directly answer questions. From time to time, also I know, especially if you're a nutrition communicator that works, whether it's in traditional media or social media, many times the trade associations, whether it be the Grocery Manufacturers Association or Food Marketing Institute or National Restaurant Association, they're hosting a lot more blogger or media tours from time to time so that organizations or individuals can have greater access to that type of information. So I think those are a couple of ways if you can search for those opportunities. Those are always wonderful opportunities to get a behind-the-scenes tour and get your questions answered. But, again, one of the first places you can start is simply by asking them for that information. More and more companies understand they need to share that with their consumers.
Great, thank you. Well, it looks like we're just about out of time. I want to thank both JJ and Sarah for their expertise and passion on this topic. I know I gained some new insights on the issue of trust and how to effectively engage and educate consumers around food and science, and I hope you all have too. So thank you for joining us, and I'm going to hand it back to Rachel to wrap it up with some important last-minute housekeeping reminders.
Great. Yes, excellent. Thank you to our presenters, and thank you to our representatives from Dairy Council of California. Just a reminder, I will send an email by Friday of this week with a link to the recording. I'll include the slides again and then the CEU certificate that you earned from your attendance today. And when I close out the session, if you'll have a chance to complete the feedback survey, we definitely appreciate any thoughts you had on today's webinar. I will encourage you to look out to the SNEB website. We have a webinar next week on hunger issues, which looks to be very interesting, and so we are still taking reservations for that webinar. And then also just a reminder, SNEB's annual conference is in San Diego this year. Early registration has been very strong, and I highly encourage you to make a room reservation if you have not yet already done so. We are seeing some, we had a great number of abstracts submitted so that we knew that there was a lot of interest in the conference, but again, the registration has been very strong. It's kind of early to us that we've seen this many number of people register. So I encourage you to do that and hope to see you again on another SNEB webinar.